Good evening, everybody. Thank you for coming tonight to this installment of Conversations with Artists. Although we have to make a sort of slight correction to that title of the series tonight, because we have two fantastic architects with us. MoMA first got to know Pablo and Jennifer of Obra Architects through the last year's Young Architects program. They were the winners, as I'm sure you know, and we sort of went on an exciting little less than a year journey with them, seeing it from the beginning of the competition to the very end. I'll tell you a little bit about their firm and then following about the individuals. Obra Architects was founded by Pablo Castro and Jennifer Lee in 2000 in New York City. The work of Obra has been exhibited here at the Museum of Modern Art, PS1 Contemporary Art Center, the Rhode Island School of Design, the Chicago Athenaeum as part of the Acadia Fabrication Conference that was held in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, and the Sandton Convention Center in Johannesburg, South Africa. Obra Architects was named one of the 2005 Emerging Voices by the Architectural League of New York, and their work has been honored with two American Architecture Awards by the Chicago Athenaeum Museum of Architecture and Design, and was published in a monograph by the United Asia Arts and Design Cooperation in Beijing in 2005. They've been published in A Plus U, Summa Plus, Architecture, Architectural Record, The New York Times, the International Herald Tribune, Concept Magazine, and Il Giornale dell'Architettura. Obra is the winner of the 2006 PS1 MoMA Young Architects Program, as I mentioned. And now, specifically about each of the architects. Pablo Castro was born in San Juan, Argentina. He was educated at the Universidad Nacional de San Juan in Argentina and holds a Master's of Science in Building Design from Columbia University Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. He has taught design studio in the Graduate Architecture Department of Pratt Institute in Brooklyn and at the Cranbrook Art Academy as architect in residence. He has lectured at the Architectural League, the Universidad Nacional de Chile, Universidad Diego Portales, Universidad Nacional de San Juan, the New Jersey Institute of Technology, the Rhode Island School of Design, Columbia, Cranbrook, and the University of Minnesota. In 2003, he was named the Montaquin Senior Fellow of the Society of Architectural Historians. Pablo is a 2006 Fellow in Architecture and Environmental Structures from the New York Foundation for the Arts. He is currently a visiting professor at Parsons, the New School for Design in New York. Jennifer Lee was born in Washington, D.C. She holds a degree from the Irwin S. Chanin School of Architecture at the Cooper Union here in New York, and she graduated with honors from Harvard. She assisted in the publication of Soundings, Architecture in Love, and Adjusting Foundations by John Hayduck, and the New York Waterfront published by the Monticelli Press while working at the Cooper Union. She has taught at the Graduate Architecture Department of Pratt in Brooklyn, as well as Cranbrook, as architect in residence as well. In 2003, she was also named a De Montaquin Senior Fellow by the Society of Architectural Historians. Jennifer is a 2006 Fellow in Architect and Environmental Structures from the New York Foundation for the Arts as well. She's currently a visiting professor at the Cooper Union. It is with great pleasure for me to introduce Pablo and Jennifer to you. I believe Pablo will be presenting, and we will follow that with a conversation and a question and answer period. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You can see Obra Architects is 50% headless. Thanks for coming tonight. As we were sitting down to figure out what to prepare for this conversation, I received an email from a friend of mine who I hadn't heard from in 10 years. He was in first year of architecture school with me, and then he transferred to a different school. He moved out of province in Argentina, and since I only saw him sporadically. But he's since graduated, and he has been practicing architecture for 15 years, both in Argentina and in Chile. And he happened to read something published about us somewhere, and he decided to email me with a question. And his question was, "How do you design?" Maybe it was because the last time that we were close friends was when we were in school, and that would seem a perfectly logical question in that context, or the fact that I am very far away makes me a target for a potentially embarrassing question for a professional who's been in practice for 15 years and asking how to design. But given that situation, we decided to propose, maybe as the subject of this conversation, how do we design? And and open up for discussion after our presentation. Who knows? Maybe we'll learn something. I'll be able to email him tomorrow with an answer. But our work, we enjoy simple, prismatic forms and minimal detailing, and practicality of use, which can be counted as the bedrocks of orthodox modernism. This seems to be enough to deal with, and it will make up for a pretty simple equation of design. But we've always felt a little bit uneasy about not attempting to introduce an element of relative darkness into that arithmetic. We haven't done that because we want to unnecessarily complicate things, but we have, on the contrary, we remain committed to simplicity, but we've always felt that there is a certain element of reality that architecture has to address that is not entirely, cannot entirely be handled effectively through reason. And since I have, since it's very difficult for me to explain this aspect of what I want to say, I will, with your permission, read a very small fragment from a French writer, a piece called Abuse of Conscience by Jean Tardieu. And, unfortunately, since I don't read French, I've come across this piece in one of the dispensable chapters of Julio Cortázar's book Hopscotch. Dispensable by his own description at the beginning of the book. You might be familiar with the book, but it's a book that you can read in many ways. And it is a second-hand translation. I think it was originally translated from the French to the Spanish, and then now, I suppose, very clumsily, it's translated by me from the Spanish to the English, so please be kind. But the piece goes like this. It says, "This house where I live resembles my own in every possible way. The arrangement of the rooms, the smell of the vestibule, the furniture, the inclined light of the morning, diffused at noon, sly in the evening. Everything is the same, including the paths and trees of the garden, the old rusted door, and the cobbled stones of the courtyard. Also, the hours and the minutes of the time that passes are similar to the hours and minutes of my life. As they swirl around me, I say to myself, they really seem like them. How much do they resemble the real hours I live in this moment? Personally, even though I have removed from my house all reflective surfaces, when even then the unavoidable glass of a window insists in returning my reflection, I see in it somebody that resembles me. Yes, he truly looks like me. I recognize him. But it should not be presumed that it is me. Come on. Everything is fake here. When they have returned to me my house and my life, then will I find my own true face." Anyways, we see here, I think, Tardieu regarding the house not simply as the place where one lives, but actually what one lives. I think in this particular piece is a stage for the perplexity at the passage of time and the way that it slowly ravages our own physical self. But the question regarding how do we design is this kind of consideration appropriate to be included in the realm of things that we consider as we work as architects. Is this undermining or completely relinquishing the freedoms that we have obtained by virtue of embracing abstraction? You know, the freedoms of experimentation in the case of architecture by limiting ourselves to just technology and program. Clement Greenberg has seen a straight line of development between Manet and Pollock, one of gradual and relentless abandonment of representation in favor of finding the true being of things in themselves. And, you know, that still sounds very good to us. But, you know, we consulted Rosalind Krauss and Yves-Vine Boy's book Formless. When through Bataille, they discuss Manet's attitude towards representation, not as a relinquishing, but actually a loosening of its grip, a kind of search for a weak representation, one that would be open, that would allow the observer to penetrate and transform, distort. Once perusing through the footnotes of Umberto Eco's opera aperta, at open work, particularly the ones of a chapter on analysis poetic language, we came across the mentioning of three different kinds of expression: descriptive expression, emotive expression, and the third one that he names as confused expression. You know, the first ones are simple enough, and the conclusion drawn are touch upon the fact that emotive expression is perhaps unavoidable. But the third one, confused expression, relies in what he calls a grammatical aberration to produce a philosophical perplexity. a philosophical perplexity. Instead of keeping oneself to the rationality of language, and it's been argued that the way to expression for architecture today is by keeping oneself close to the coherence, the formal coherence of an accepted architecture or invented architectural language. And we find in this, we feel tempted by this suggestion of assuming a kind of iconoclastic attitude and, you know, perhaps consider the use of grammatical aberrations in architectural form to try to elicit that sort of philosophical perplexity. I wonder what that really means. I mean, what is an aberration of language? And, you know, I'm thinking about it, and I thought, and I haven't gone into very deep, literally speaking, but I thought, you know, maybe the very, very famous quote from Rimbaud would serve. You know, I is another is, I guess, an aberration. Or, you know, there's a book by Cortázar that is written in the second person, utilizing both the formal and the informal forms in Spanish to refer a story that is presented as a talk with a son and his mother, both at the same time. So there's no change of form, just change of, there's no change of person, just change of form. So a kind of attack on the accepted rules of language to suggest a transcendence towards a reality that language cannot encompass. Anyways, so this has to be very fast, but we proposed then, you know, perhaps 10 points of aberration, a kind of guide for the architecturally perplexed, following Maimonides. But the first one that we suggested is what we call literal translations. This will be an illustrated set of points. and we will illustrate it then with some of our projects. This one is a project called Freedom Park, and it was a two-round international competition that we did in 2003, of which our project was declared one of the winners. There was no definitive winner, but, you know, oddly enough, there were three winners. But that's another story. This is a slide of the site, which is a hill to the south of Pretoria, the capital of South Africa. It's called Savelkop Hill. There are several hills, and this is one of the ones that is unoccupied. You can see to the top of the slide the University of South Africa. And to the left, with those beautiful purple trees, those are jacaranda trees, by the way, imported from Brazil. They are the neighborhood of Savelkop. We came across our investigations in preparation for proposing something for the project, a tradition that is common to many communities in South Africa, and is that when somebody important for the community dies, the people find the largest living baobab tree in the vicinity, and because the trunk is very soft and pulpous, they dig in the trunk of the tree a grave for this person. And since the tree continues to live, it metaphorically gives the person not only a splendid physical presence, but also a kind of immortality. So we thought that that was so beautiful, and then we decided to adopt very literally that idea of the trunk of a tree to shape a building. So we shaped the project was made up of basically a memorial and a museum with some administrative offices. You can see on the top of the hill in the middle, the memorial shape as a trunk of a baobab tree built in brick with a whitewash interior. This structure is 30 meters in diameter, 50 meters high, and it has an oculi on top of 5 meters in diameter, and it's cut with windows that have been covered with acid-edged glass with the likeness of the people that the memorial is dedicated to, and as the sun moves across the sky, it projects a ghostly parade of the faces of the memorialized on the concavity of the whitewashed walls. And then logically, it's just a simple step to consider the museum as a group of trees that, growing in close proximity to each other, have grown to fuse into each other. A second project to illustrate the same idea is a Tito Glass Art Museum in Taipei, in Taiwan, that we did in 2004. This was a invited competition, international competition of five firms, and in this competition we came in second, unfortunately. Taipei, you might know, is a very vibrant 24-hour city, and the site was on a very busy avenue that bisects a park, and the park is the building is set on the park. And across the street from the Fine Art Museum of Taipei. And our idea, very quickly, was centered around the common ability of architecture and glass art in this case, to capture light into a space that is physically impenetrable in the case of glass and inhabitable in the case of architecture. This is a piece by Czech artist Stanislav Levinsky. And one of the members of the jury, actually the only Western non-Taiwanese member of the jury, was Marian Carroll from Prague, who had been a student of Stanislav Levinsky in art school. He's now the director of the Academy of Fine Arts in Prague, and the best thing, I guess, that we got out of this is that we got to know him and that we became friendly with him. The project itself was configured as a series of lanterns that extend the entire height of the building, cutting through the roof and generating light wells that bring natural light to every single space inside the museum. At the same time, those lanterns in their convexity define rooms that are configured by the balancing pressures of this convexity onto their space, and create spaces that are appropriate for the showing of different types of glass art, and that flow into each other almost having no perceptible beginning and no end. So the second proposed point is called the big room strategy. And we will use the same two projects to illustrate it very quickly. This is a section through the Museum of Freedom Park, which is 10 galleries. And it was very important for the organizers of the competition to introduce an element of in the exhibits that was called a historical continuum. They part of the intention was to demonstrate the presence of human life in the country all the way back to prehistoric times. And there's a political reason for this. The Afrikaner that had been controlling the country through apartheid used the argument that the country was basically empty when they arrived, and therefore they were as entitled to control the country as anybody else. Our project used structural slabs that sectioned the space in uneven portions, and you have to imagine the plan, unfortunately. But there were four tree trunks fused into each other. One was given to vertical circulation, and the other three constituted the galleries. The movement through the galleries occurred utilizing very gentle ramps. But to develop the length of the ramp, you always had to go through one room to go from one of the other two. So there was always a threeness about movement through space. So you were always in immediate relationship with the space before and the space after, and then you had deep perspectives of the spaces beyond. Effectively, we think materializing a metaphor of a conception of time, you know, a linear conception of time into the past and the future. We were there were really, really good signs as we were preparing the project for this competition, because at in Film Forum, which is two blocks away from our office, they had at the time they were showing a movie called Amandla, that is a documentary about the role of song in the fight against apartheid in South Africa. So Jennifer and I went to see it two or three times, and then one night after working until like 2 in the morning, we got home totally exhausted, and we switched on the TV to unwind, and there was PBS had a program called Simunji, which means together. It was about singing choirs from Soweto traveling to England to bring the music. So I think that they were staying until like 6 in the morning watching this thing. So we knew that we had a good project when all that was happening. This is the Teatot Museum, which also uses the idea of the brick room strategy. And we felt that this was appropriate here because through the utilizing the very same material that we're exhibiting, glass, we define these rooms, as I said, they have no beginning and no end. And it was kind of a flexible method to determine different spaces that could be used for the exhibition of this glass. But the thing that was interesting is we imagined that a visitor to the museum, after having gone through the collection, will have an easier time having a clear idea not only of the individual pieces that have been seen in any individual gallery, but maybe of the entire collection or part of the collection. In other words, the pieces were experienced and remembered not only in isolation, but you could, as curator, stage a relationship between the pieces that could become memorable once the space had been visited. And here you can see some of the plans in which the only interior partitions are the lanterns in themselves. This is a much more humble project that utilizes the same idea. This is a house for a friend of mine, actually, in Argentina, an architect, too, or I should say a former architect. He had received a large inheritance from his father, who was had a shipbuilding business, and he had unfortunately passed away. And he decided to use his, and you can see us, too, up there on the top. He's on the left wearing dark, and I'm under the fig tree in the shade because it's very hot. But he used that inheritance to quit architecture because he didn't want to. hear of it anymore. And he bought himself a vineyard, and he was going to grow grapes. But he had decided that he was going to design one last project, and this was this house. But after trying it for a little while, he called me and said, look, I'm really having psychological problems with this task that I've given myself, and I want you to design my house. So we did this project for him that he plans to start construction in this year. The project, as I said, is in a vineyard, but it's physically in an orchard on the edge of the vineyard, and the orchard is made out of, you know, fig trees, lemon trees, and peach trees. And it's located strategically to preserve the trees in the house, and the trees become in themselves the focus of life in the house, surrounded by circular courtyards. The concavity of the courtyards is given to individual spaces that could be places of shared experience or individual experience for the members of the house. But at the same time, in the reverse space of their concavity, allows the house to float, to kind of skip around them to the necessary spaces for this house. So when all the doors are open, it's almost a house that has no walls. It has no a kind of endless house. You can never, you know, it's all beyond. There's always a substantial level of beyond. Our third point we call meta architecture. And, you know, that is a notion that the project is done with a primary intention of creating something other than the something beyond or more important than the specific interior space that is defined for the architecture, for the primary intention by which the project is being made. For example, I'm not being very clear, but I'll illustrate it with this project. This is a project we did for a housing project in the city of Guanajuato in Mexico in 2002. It was 1,200 units of housing outside of the city of Guanajuato. In a former ranch nearby the Rio Guanajuato, and it was given to also the intention it was going to be given to sustainable technologies, which in 2002 were already important. They weren't as important as they are now, or as popular as they are now, but it was kind of a promising proposition. At this time, this is Guanajuato itself, which was quite beautiful. And a view of the surroundings near the river, which the landscape is very luscious, but there's a lot of clay in the land, so the water skips and not much stays, and a lot of the vegetation is kind of the desert type of vegetation. So this is a site itself, and anyways. But you can see there were hills and valleys, and we used the valleys on which there were existing roads to create the access roads. There were two types of dwellings. What you see as a linear parts of the model was detached or semi-detached, or row housing, I should say, with a garden and a place to park a car. And they define a kind of neighborhood street. The neighborhood streets went down from the top of the hill where the access road was to the valleys, which had been preserved where the little trees are, which had been preserved as urban parks. The water was collected on the roof of those houses and then run in the aqueduct. You can see the aqueduct there as a serpent on the edge between the houses and the park, creating a space that could be occupied for the, you know, typical markets that all Mexican cities have, or just simply to stroll on the edge of the park. And the water was taken to the circular structures. The circular structures like everything else, had a double function. They contained the water in the basement in a big cistern, and then on top of the cistern, they defined a public plaza around which we arrange, a space for shops and community spaces. The project afforded two different lifestyles possibility, one more urban around the plaza and the other one more suburban. But more importantly, I think it was a project in which the primacy of the individual space of the house is challenged by common good. In other words, the spaces surrounding the houses do not become what we oftentimes see unfortunately is a leftover space that is just named as public space. But the public space was designed as much as the individual space of the houses. And part of the interest in this is not only the definition of those two things, but I think the actual deformation to what is typically considered primary. You know, the way that the interior of the houses need to be stretched or pulled or bent to create a space beyond, which in this case was physically and metaphorically defined, the public space of the complex and also the actual common effort of collecting and preserving the water to create a kind of urban forest in those valleys. This is a section of the apartments. This in particular was a handicap unit, and it was accessed by a giant Guggenheim-style ramp. Another meta architecture project is a CNC manufacturing facility that we've designed in Long Island in New York. This is a project that is entirely done in cast-in-place concrete panels. The entire structure is made out of that, and it was designed in collaboration with, I should mention my collaborators for the other projects, but in collaboration with Robert Silman Associates from here from New York. And you can see it's a little bit like a Kito Parts. You can see all the panels here. It has 68,000 square feet of manufacturing space and offices. The manufacturing space is downstairs. And they are trusses, as you can see, going north-south, let's say, that that span the space itself with the minimum amount of support columns possible. There are six columns. These trusses have a height that is inhabitable. So we use that height, that space, to locate the offices and the spaces for employee amenities, such as cafeteria. There's a gym, and by switching the height of the roof of the manufacturing space, light is not only let into the manufacturing space, but also we create on the roof a kind of a couple of promenades that people can utilize to spend time outside without being out of the building, but actually being on the roof. Have lunch and things like that. But here again, the definition of this part of the building of the factory itself is the form is transformed by the desire to create a kind of interior and exterior space at the same time that has more than one function. Our first strategy we call centrifugal space. If we can consider that meaning is easily identified with centralized, defined space, a hierarchical space in which you can, feel what has more importance if you're near the center and less importance if you move away from it. Our project, which we put to practice in what we call the Radial House, which is a project in New York for the year 2005, challenges that notion by locating a substantial amount of mass of the building away from that center. So this is, I think, perhaps a good example of what we're trying to say. Representation is not totally renounced. It's given in a way, but in a weak form. The representation is given, the centrality is there, but it's challenged by this centrifugal force that makes it open. So there's a sense that there is something there, but that something is weak enough that we can project our meanings onto it. Here you can see the quick perspective of the central space. Centrifugal House is another example of the same idea being built currently in New York. We started this project last year. This is specifically in Southampton. And this is a view of the plan for the early design. When we presented this to our clients, they said, "We love it. We just don't like the roundness." So I hope they're here, or hello. So we had to effect some changes here, but I think the spirit has survived, hopefully in some form. So you can see it became the hexagonal house, and in the massing of the structure, we see this very large, oversized, out of proportion windows, out of proportion in a certain sense, as materializing ways of escape for this centrifugal force that is defined by the geometry of the house. This is a view of the foundation of the house, and I think this photo was taken yesterday. They're starting to work on the framing. The last example for this is the tripartite house for East Hampton in New York. It's a project of 2005. This was a group of three lots that were given to different architects, actually two architects, one of them, Mark Mack, and us. And this project sort of never happened, but I guess, again, one of the best things about it is that we became friendly with Mark Mack, who's a great guy. So the idea of this project is similar to the radial house, is creating centers that traditionally, or points of the house that are traditionally considered as centers of meaning, in this case, the courtyard house. But the way that it's undermined in this particular case is the fact that there are three of them, and every one of them seems to respond to a different geometry, creating a kind of collision and a secondary set of geometries, angles, and unexpected spaces in the point where they meet. Here is an image of one. And there's a whole story about also this kind of low-tech curtain wall that defines the courtyards. But we have to move on. Point five we call curved space. And curved space is a long story. But to make a long story short, this in 2004, we traveled to Uruguay on a fellowship to study the work of engineer architect Eladio Dieste, who was doing this shell structures that were a new development at the time, done in concrete, but he was doing them in brick. And he had, inspired by the work of Gaudí, he was speaking about against actually the orthodox attitude of modernism in their predilection for the design and construction of plain forms, because they're easy to analyze and because society is tool to build them. He was interested in not only in the aesthetic qualities, I should say mostly in the structural qualities of curved form, which he described as naturally appropriate and effective to cover great spans, not by virtue of an awkward accumulation of material, but actually by the shape themselves. But form for it's more than a curve form is more than that. You know, the definition of space by curve form, in a way, suggests a kind of intimacy with something that is endless. You know, you can never get to the, you can constantly go around a sphere and never get to the other side of it. It's sort of a humble challenge to Cartesianism. It has something about it that just goes beyond the structural qualities. This is a small project that we did for a pavilion in Coney Island. You might have heard of this competition. It was called the Parachute Pavilion, and its site was under the parachute jump. And our idea was to create four oculi in a parachute-like roof, so the patrons of this is to be a restaurant would always have to always be under the presence of the parachute jump. And our intention was inspired by Diestis ranting against the technology of modern architecture, a way of both protesting and accepting the rules of of contemporary practice. And our intention was to create a curved dome utilizing all flat material. So in this particular dome, we use very quickly two arrays of rings. These rings are inclined away from themselves as they separate from the center in such a way that they, when you connect two rings, they always connect at 90 degrees. So the connection is always the same. There's one piece of hardware. But as they are assembled ring by ring and then connected with the other array, they naturally form a curved surface. This is the project that Peter was mentioning before that probably some of you know. This is the PS1 MoMA Young Architects Program for 2006 that we were incredibly lucky to get. And this is a photo of the model with which we won the competition. This is a very large model. This is was a project that is, I guess, a descendant of our Parachute Pavilion project and a case in point of trying to transform flat structure into curved structure to achieve more effective structural performance. I keep going. You can see here the you can see here one of the domes and the kind of definition of that void that was one of the main intentions of our project. We saw this is a very large space and it has a relatively humble budget and a very, very tight schedule. And many of the projects that have been done in the past have pronounced sculptural qualities because of those reasons, because it's very hard to fill up the whole space. So we set out to do something that was very difficult. It looked very easy in the model while we were doing the competition, but which was to create in a space of mostly interiorized feeling, a space that you can experience from the inside and that is hard to see from the outside. The idea of this is that the real reason for the project was this fantastically successful warm-up program that the PS1 runs in the summers that attracts thousands of New Yorkers and is a true institution of the city. We saw this event, that, you know, the repeated experience of this event as a true aesthetic phenomenon that needed to be prolonged, and we wanted to create just the background for it. We just wanted to contain it. That was our entire aspiration. We were somewhat successful. We had to climb on the roof of nearby buildings to be able to photograph it from outside, because otherwise it does not have much of an outside. Point six, it's deliberate incompleteness inspired by some of the works of Arte Povera. Here you can see one of Michelangelo Pistoletto's minus objects. Sorry. I don't think I told you about that one. I'll exemplify that with a housing project that we did in Chile in 2003. This was a prototype housing project for any 100 meter by 100 meter city block in Chile, which was, you know, they're very common because according following the law of Indias with which the cities were founded, they were by law partitioned that way. And the project needed to house 150 families. The main beneficiaries of this type of project are farmers that are moving to the city in search for a new opportunity, and they get a very, very, very small space. They get 40,000 square meters, but they get no debt. It's subsidized housing, and they get the capacity to duplicate the size of their space, which was the biggest challenge for our project. We propose that a relatively rigid concrete structure that would admit on its roof the renovations that were to be done, the expansions that were to be done by the occupants themselves, and that we anticipated in the very same kind of lightweight, extremely colorful architecture that characterizes some of the vernacular architecture in Chile. You can see here that we provided the precast concrete columns for to facilitate their expansions, and while those expansions are happening, they, you know, could perhaps throw a couple of wires there and create a pergola for themselves and an expansion to their house. The configuration was the intention of create a kind of permeability. You can see that there are two directions for the entire complex, and one is above and the other one is below. The intention of that was to create a permeability or a capacity for people to penetrate the block, so as not to create a kind of fortress, and to create as much open space as possible for these people to continue to do some of the activities that they used to do, you know, engage in the activities that they used to engage in when they lived in the countryside, plant tomatoes or chirimoyas or, you know, play soccer. In a metaphoric way, the same kind of incompleteness is part of PS1 as I described, because, you know, this is a very beautiful slide of the kind of emptiness that the space encompasses, but you would have to admit that this is the way that it was meant to be. You can see this is one warm-up day. In its entirety. The seventh is direct correspondence, which means very simply to take what is there, you know, to kind of weave the project into its site, and by this we mean that just the physical site, but also the more intangible aspects of the site. For example, my friend Fernando's house had, you know, we envisioned we have two ways of measuring time, one sort of cyclical and one linear. As the sun moved across the sky, the quality of the light to which each one of these courtyards is exposed changes, effectively changing the experience of the house and the spaces surrounding the courtyard. But also there's a linear sequence of time that has to do with the trees of the orchard growing older and sort of obscuring the light in the interior of the house, you know, maybe. And then at a simpler but I think very effective level, I mean at least a level that we were very happy with, the palette of colors, for example, in the house is on the edge of the Andes, which, you know, furnishes the landscape with a kind of a layered horizon. And the latest layer of this horizon, the one that corresponds to the highest mountains of the Andes, is this kind of cobalt blue. So the interior of the house, when you see out of the window and you see the mountains, the kind of, we try to, the vision is to try to match, to try to fuse, to kind of collapse that depth by the choice of color. And then more playfully, the floors are proposed as stained concrete that are the same color as the Burgundy grapes that he's growing in his new vineyard. In PS1, we search for a similar way of weaving the project into what's there. And there were two things. One was this civic importance that I've already mentioned, you know, the fact that warm-up and PS1 itself is so important for New Yorkers now because of, not only because of their exhibits and their work that they do for contemporary art, but also in a very fun, immediate way that everybody relates to because of warm-up. And students of the history of architecture that we are, we related that pretty quickly with one of the earliest typologies, architectural typologies that had such a civic importance. I guess since we could not be inspired by Roman circles, we were inspired by Roman baths. And there were three, there, you know, the issue of correspondence that I'm talking about was that there are three courtyards in PS1 that are part of the project, and there, as you know, you might know, there are three distinct areas of a Roman bath, you know, that or the very, very cold water, which is the Frigidarium, that which we assign here the small gallery in blue, and then the caldarium, which is very, very hot water, and then the tepidarium, which is the temperate water, which is here in brown. Here you can see a view of the caldarium, which has no shade and has a pool, and is given to sunbathing. It's here now invaded with people, but it was a somewhat cloudy day. So they venture in there. And then you can see here a view of our frigidarium completely lined with insulation and metallic bubble wrap. And you see on the floor part of the 12 blocks of ice that were delivered every Saturday morning to create the cold space. Laconic articulation refers to the fact that an unnecessary abundance of materials and complicated detailing in our eyes betrays a kind of materialistic spirit. And we always endeavor to subtract in that realm. And for example, here in the house in Argentina, we have accepted vernacular, very, very low-tech materials such as adobe blocks, which will be used for the house, and cane reeds, which we use for the roof, and poplar trunk trees, in the case of as beams. And then in the case of PS1, you can see this, it almost also has a kind of default materiality. I mean, the steel brackets could not have been done any other way. And the wood for the beams has very good structural performance, but the characteristic that was the most interesting to us was the fact that they were for free. Somebody gave them to us. So, and the one that we were a little fussier about was the scales that you see, because, I'll get to that. But the scales took a lot of experimenting. The one is Zimsum, light space. In the Kabbalah, you know, Zimsum means... this was defined by Isaac Luria, means the way that God shrinked to allow for room for creation. You know, so when he created the world, he actually made himself somehow smaller without diminishing himself to allow for all the things to be. And this, you know, you see it kind of sort of blends in with curved space and centrifugal space, and everything starts to... But what is interesting, I think, it's to remark upon the fact that light and space go together in this way. And if there's no light, the space is not perceivable, and therefore is as if it didn't exist. We discover in our PS1 presentation that experimenting with ways of creating shade to create this tepidarium space, that it created a penumbra of moiré that was very interesting, because it kind of... define a space that you enter as if you were suddenly to go underwater. You know, it really created this being a project without walls, it kind of created a sense of interiority that went beyond what was just defined by the roof. So we went through a hardest process of blowing this up at the right, at the scale, and obtaining the very same or similar effect. And I think we were relatively successful. The moiré was quite effective. And here you can see the light contributing to the sense of heat that you would get in the caldarium. And here, people using the caldarium even off-season. This was in October, when the project was supposed to have been dismantled already, but museum chose to retain it one more month, so this is fully jacket-cladded people are enjoying the caldarium and the sunshine. Light, of course, was the main issue with lanterns that were at the same time water misters that helped to cool the environment, but they work by day and by night, and people gather around them as if they were campfires or fireplaces. They would meet each other there and linger by them. They were kind of give them something to pay attention to. And it was quite beautiful the way they capture the light. They were originally inspired by clouds being caught in the top of the Empire State on a stormy night. 10 radical pragmatism refers to the notion that oftentimes the familiar serves for a vehicle of the fantastic. that the strange is strange, you know, the strange is incredibly or inexplicably similar to the familiar. And we feel, you know, this is a longer story, but we've always tried to retain, we think that the way of achieving a sense of strangeness most effectively is to be as practical and pragmatic as we possibly can. This is a project of an exhibit of our work at the Rhode Island School of Design in 2004. There's a project that was done in our office utilizing a laser cutter that one of our clients gave us as a gift. It was a little bit like writing an important piece of music on a toy piano, because our laser cutter was very small and it took a long time to cut the pieces. There were thousands of pieces, and it took about 3 months of the machine working 8 hours a day for us to cut all the pieces. We did these mock-ups to test the light. You know, being in Chinatown, we had access to a lot of light bulbs. And in the back, you can see the boxes that we were going to use to ship this these pieces to Rhode Island. Here is we're testing the layouts of the work in our office on the floor, and here are the students in Rhode Island installing the piece, which they did with, you know, written instructions from us. So we felt that, and this substantially changed the project, that there was need to create some form of compensation and stimulus to the students. So we etched in our laser cutter what we call lessons in most of the pieces that were to come together to assemble the wall. Here's with some help from Wallace Stevens. The pieces would come out of the box, and the students would read them to each other and laugh and comment and connect them, and they literally, the lessons would sort of bring up the wall. Here's Akira reading one of them. The same way, you know, a somewhat extravagant scheme for a housing project in Chile with all these colonnaded promenades and elevated walkways is made possible by embracing a strong sense of practicality. This is a precast technology that exists, in place. It's unfortunately mostly being employed to build prisons. But we utilize it to break up the housing complex into a kit of six parts that could be recombined to create the entire project, and therefore made it affordable. In the case of Freedom Park in South Africa, the museum and memorial, we model the shape of the tree trunks in a computer to achieve a catenary shape that would be subject only to compression strength. And then that way we allow to build the skin of these structures in a thin layer of about, you know, 3 to 4 inches of brick, utilizing the cooked dirt from the very site, the red African dirt. This would be, you know, a somewhat large masonry project, but we thought that that could be actually an advantage to the project, given that there's a high percentage of unemployment in South Africa, and the one corresponding to the people in Savokop Hill, the you know, little neighborhood with the jacaranda trees, was one of the highest. So we felt this was an opportunity for some of these young people to learn a profession as masons and then move on to work in possibly other projects across the country. And this would develop a kind of early bond of interdependence between the project and the people. In Taiwan, the lanterns work in the same way. This was a structural cylindrical trusses that were designed by the office of Guy Nornson & Associates here in New York. And then with the help of Ove Arup, New York, we turned those lanterns into not only channels of natural and artificial light throughout the spaces, but also as channels of distribution of HVAC and energy reclaim from the kilns that are used to make the glass. This is PS1 again, and these are some diagrams that were done by Transolar, a company that does environmental design, with which we have a very close collaboration. They manage through a combination of steam and shadow and evaporation from the pools to lower the temperature in the tepidarium by about 5 degrees and make a true difference that you could actually perceive as you went from one to another space. You see that PS1 fortunately brought to a lot of people together. And, you know, as and when we were building and afterwards when we were actually experiencing it, there were a lot of twos going around. But this is the concertina, what we call the concertina dome, which was designed as a dome that was modeled in the computer. And then a grid was projected on it and collapsed. When the grid was collapsed, all the pieces, none of the pieces were straight. But in reconnecting those pieces, we effectively were able to recreate the shape that we had in the computer. So we obtained curved space from flat material, as we had been trying to do. This was a project that would have not been possible to do without utilizing the latest technologies of digital manufacturing. This project was done without any paper. Everything was from a file, the same file that was used to make the model that was presented during the competition was used to build the actual project, and we just emailed those files to our manufacturers in Minnesota, where we found CNC technology was cheaper. The same thing happened with the beams. This is the original idea. This is how we envisioned how easy it was going to be to put this together. Needless to say, it didn't quite work that way. And here is our friend Toby Bergman designed a system to support the domes from above, utilizing this goalpost system, which made for a very beautiful night landscape. And once the domes were all tied together, the strings could be removed and the goalposts could be removed. It was sheer genius. And here's some view of that and the domes finished. The pools were built the last, and it cost quite a few headaches because we were running out of time, but they had to be left for the last because we couldn't drive on them. So it took quite a few all-nighters to get them done, but eventually people got to enjoy them. Here you can see the entire process of construction capture in film. Pretty easy, huh? And then the loose objects. This is just a quick bonus point, but, you know, it's a consumer society, and we have to admit that we have sinned. We don't want you to find out later. We designed some branded objects for PS1. We think it's a worthwhile cost. This is a T-shirt that we propose as the appropriate attire to be worn in the tepidarium, but PS1 decided not to produce them because they already had T-shirts, and they had a different idea. But we did make some prototypes. These were designed in collaboration with Omnivore. And we wore them. Here's Luis inspecting the work in Minneapolis. We wore them, and our team wore them almost continuously during the entire process of competing, including the presentation to the jurors, and all the time, an entire week, that it took the jurors to decide who the winner was. You know, out of superstition, we decided not to take the T-shirts off, not even when we were sleeping. So they were in pretty bad shape by the time. Some of the people that came to PS1 decided to bring friends, and we sort of anticipated that, and we had proposed to PS1 a line of pool toys that they could produce. And as part of this would be adequate for the Caldarium. And I brought one of them Since there's a kind of Q&A afterwards, we thought that this could be a good incentive for somebody to ask a really smart question. You could, if that person is you, you can take this duck away with you after this is, after this is done, okay? And then finally, for the Frigidarium, we had proposed an item that this ladies would have found quite helpful, but that PS1 decided not to produce, unfortunately. So somebody had to brand the ice in a quite literal way. So just to finish, and very quickly, sort of, I try to do this as fast as I could. There's a quick movie for those of you who missed PS1. This is the next best thing, and I think we're going to see that now, right? Movie. Light, camera, action. Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I was told that that's about the same 20 people dancing in that video, and they're either your students or your staff.
And so then most of them, they're sitting in this room.
Really, yeah. Putting them to work. So perhaps we'll start, and I'd like to give Jennifer an opportunity to speak and talk about your practice a little bit, in addition to discussing the projects. I'm interested always in knowing a little bit more about how two designers collaborate. I had a very interesting visit to Glenn Merkitt's studio back in May in Australia, and one thing I sort of discovered while I was there was that he designs everything with his partner, Wendy Lewin, and what they do is Glenn sits on one side of a table and Wendy sits on another, and they have a piece of trace paper in between them. Glenn has a black pen and Wendy has a red pen, and they draw over each other. In fact, occasionally one will cross out something the other has done, and it's a sort of visual transcript of a debate process in design. So I'm wondering how you approach your collaboration and what is the nature of it. One thing you had mentioned to me when I was visiting with you the other day was that I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but Pablo tells you not to look out the window too much or something to that effect. Perhaps you can elaborate that dynamic a little bit.
I think that's a good question. And I think that everybody has different methods and different, particularly in the creative process. I think it is so individualized. For us, all I can say is that we work, we work constantly. So we are usually, a good example is even coming to this lecture. We were working on it up until the last second. Mm-hmm. Whatever needs to get done, gets done. And we're working at it, and everyone who works in our office, everyone in the audience who is, is out there, who works with us, can, attest to the fact that we're constantly
burning the midnight oil.
Basically, burning the midnight oil and doing whatever needs to get done in order to make a project find itself.
That has to change.
Ever.
Yeah, we need a vacation, actually. But I think also the one interesting thing about the process is that it has its own. It's neither one of us in a way. It has the what we work on has a kind of life of its own that we try to allow to happen. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers.
I think it, Can I say something?
Yes, absolutely.
I think she's being too modest in a way. I mean, Jennifer's a much more refined spirit than me. And I think the way that we divide labor is I do sort of the more rough stuff, and she refines it and makes sure it's of the utmost quality, at least as much as we can achieve, and refinement. She's always in charge of putting in the finishing touches, and everything that our offers produces goes through the design hands, you know, Jennifer's design hands, to make sure that it's like that. We had, as you mentioned, we had the fortune of having a monograph published on ourselves, on our work, and the entire graphic design of that book was done by Jennifer working alone, and at least we're in the process of trying to refine a method of representing architectural work by photographing architectural models, and we used to have our own photographer, but she got deported. So, but now all of our photographs are done by Jennifer, and I think that not only is she approaching the quality of this professional photographer that was a friend of ours, who's a really good photographer from Argentina, I'm kind of joking, but she's, from the point of view of photographing architectural models, I think she's surpassing that kind of quality.
That has to do with allowing a project to be visual, be represented, and be visualized, allowing it to be envisioned.
But for the point of view of architectural conception, it's a true collaboration that, you know, we take turns at coming up with ideas and criticizing each other's ideas. So, and we not only happens amongst ourselves, but we try to stimulate people to work with us to participate in that process too. You know, I think that if the studio is vital with discussion on ideas, I think the projects by necessity will get better, and that only works if people are outspoken and, you know, have a desire to participate and have an influence, make the project theirs. This is one of the greatest things about PS1. It was just such a difficult thing to do in such a short period of time that we had to not only, you know, gather a large group of people that would participate, but, you know, implicitly trust them right away. I mean, there was no trial time, we just had to do it. So, okay, you're going to do this, go do it, and, you know, we'll pray that it's going to come out right. And, you know, people really came through. Once that responsibility is in place and that trust is given, it's amazing how productive and effective you can be. So, you know, we obviously not always achieve it, but that's what we aspire to, you know.
One thing you also told me was that you believe very strongly that who you go to work for as your first job as an architect is incredibly important, and that those decisions have to be made very carefully, and that's something that you reiterate to people when you're, say, interviewing them. I don't think I mentioned this in the beginning, but both of you have worked for some, you know, big distinguished firms here in New York, including Richard Meyer and Stephen Hall, which is where you met. Perhaps you can tell us, one, about why you believe that sort of first job is so important and influential, and also tell us something about the sort of joys and fear involved with that moment when you decided to jump ship, as they say, and start your own firm, because you know, it's a very scary moment for most architects when they decide to take that course. So,
well, when I mentioned a little bit of this to you before, but when I interview, which I do relatively often, even though we don't hire that often, if I can't give them a job, at least I'm going to give them good advice, you know. And so one thing that I definitely probably lecture a little bit too much on is I'm sorry I can't, you know, I'm sorry I can't hire you, but please be very, very careful about where you go. And that the only reason that I feel very strongly about that is because once you start to, ride the line on the wrong side of architectural production, perhaps I should say, then it's hard to turn back. You know, so architecture as a discipline is so difficult, and to achieve, I think, good work is so difficult that you have to be in the right kind of, laboratory in order to really learn how to produce good architecture. And, you know, we are indebted to all the people that we worked for. You know, we definitely worked very hard for a lot of other, you know, for other people. But during that, you know, we also feel very grateful for that time, because that's when you really sort of pump your muscles and learn how to run really fast, you know, for very long times. So.
Pablo, what about the fears and joys of starting your own office and establishing a sort of base for yourself as a firm?
Well, Jennifer tells me that it's very scary, but I'm very irresponsible, so I never know. It is tough, you know. It is. When we started our office, we started out of a tiny apartment that I had on Spring Street and Mulberry. It was a walk-up on the sixth floor, and it was, you know, smaller than most closets. It was a very, very tiny apartment. And we moved out because of there with the office, because somebody was going to give us a job supervising somebody else's project in New York, and this architect was going to come interview us, and we were convinced that if he saw the way that we lived and worked in the same place, we would never get the job. We never did get the job in the end, but at least that pushed us out. And then we are, you know, architecture is about space, and we're very privileged to have a really, really good space to work in. You know, we have a nice space on the fourth floor on Church Street in Chinatown, and which we found because we were doing a work in the building, renovating a space for a doctor's office. It was, you know, it's a kind of run-down building and badly maintained. So it's, or it was at the time, a little bit cheaper than most, so we could take the risk, but it was a huge risk, and all of our savings went into it. And the unfortunate thing about the story was that it was on the eve of 9/11. Actually, we were talking about, we moved in May 2001. So by September of that very same year, we had no work, because we had been surviving on doing residential and commercial renovations in the city, and all the work stopped at the time for that kind of business. So we found ourselves with what was a huge rent for our standards, and with no work. And since we were below the line of Canal Street, we got a little bit of help from the government, but basically we had to take big loans and, you know, hope that things would get better. And, you know, the best thing that we can say about a, you know, very horrible situation for everybody else was that that forced us to get out of the renovation building. I think we haven't done the renovation business since then. And since there was nothing else to do, we just signed up to do as many competitions as we could. And, you know, they always tell you that you never get very far doing competitions. And it's, you know, probably true. I mean, it feels true. It's very hard. But we didn't have any other choice, so that's what we did, how we got out. We also had to pay due to the fact that it's very hard, you know, I was telling you this the other day when you came to visit, it's very hard to see people go, you know, that have worked with you, because for the work to be effective and the team to work, you know, to produce good work, you have to develop a bond that goes beyond the professional, you know, and it has a measure of the effective in it. And, you know, it's always very hard to spend all those nights together, you know, putting these things and sharing your thoughts and trying to create something and then somebody goes and then you don't see them again. So, you know, I understand that it must have also been hard for the people that employed us to let us go. But, for example, Stephen Hall was very generous because after we left, he helped us by giving us some work. There's one house that we worked in collaboration with him. There's a project that we had that we did while we were still working with him. And we have done construction detailing and construction documents and construction detail and observation afterwards. So that was, you know, an extension of the generosity of allow you to work there, allow you to develop your own. So, you know, it's difficult, yeah.
I'm afraid we don't have too much time, so I want to open it up to questions from the audience. I believe we have a wireless mic somewhere around. Perhaps over here on the right, the lady. All right.
We went through the entire McMaster car catalog, page by page. We really tried every single material that you could possibly conceive of, and we had called every industrial fabric manufacturer there was. But it came down to just needing something that was rigid enough and something that was light enough. You know, if you call, for anyone who's a student here, if you call McMaster car, you can get free samples. So we had, at some point, our office felt like a McMaster car storage supply house or something, because we really did have a foot long piece of sample fabric from every single manufacturer in McMaster car. But so we ended up using polypropylene because that was it's usually used to filter as a filtering. Material, but you can get it in a dense enough, in a large enough density, dense enough proportion and thick enough so that it could achieve that kind of rigidity. So that's what we used, polypropylene mesh, which is also UV protected. So
the challenge was that the scales would open, you know, to let the wind through and then fall back to the position that they were supposed to have to cover and create the shade. So they had to be, they couldn't be too rigid or too soft, otherwise they would either stay open or never, you know, or never stay fold or never open up. And then the weight was another consideration, and then the way that it did or did not create this kind of effect, this effect of moiré that we were interested in architecturally. They were, each one of the connections of the concertina had a bolt, that, you know, this wood dome, and the scales were attached in one point in that bolt so they could actually rotate. But they were also attached with a plastic string in the bottom as a restrainer so they wouldn't fall over. So they would open to a certain extent.
Also, yeah. From McMaster car.
Maybe... two more questions. Brad, do you want to?
Thank you. First of all, it's lovely work, and it's a real gift that you've decided to go through so systematically and talk about your inspirations and kind of the mental through lines that you used to hold up these things. I'm hoping you're going to make some playing cards or something that will help remind us.
That's a good idea.
You've given us kind of the... the other thing that's really lovely and that ties into the question, I promise... is that even though they're mostly formalist concerns, you always talked about them in terms of the humanist values that supported those concerns. And that's why I call the work lovely. That's really beautiful. Thanks. Stuff. Even when you said ruthlessly practical or whatever, you know, point 9 or 10 was, the practical thing was giving the soul back to your workers by putting the little, you know, giving them some poetry as they built it, and that's a gorgeous, gorgeous thing. So thank you.
Thanks.
Now that we know the top 10, 10 and a half, 11 points that we should be shooting for, I wonder if you could talk to what dark side you are getting the students to avoid? I would love to know two or three things that are warning signs at these bad firms or bad thought processes.
You haven't come up with that list yet, have
compromise
you?
Compromise is one thing. Compromise. We refuse to compromise. That means pushing way past a kind of physical limit that you could ever imagine possible. So that's kind of, I mean, maybe that's, you know, I think that sometimes you encounter a situation where certain restrictions, limitations don't allow you to allow a work to achieve its potential. And that happens a lot in a firm that has actually an operational business, which maybe to a certain degree we're not really. You know, we're kind of more focused on how to make the work really achieve its potential. That's always our bottom line. So I'm just, you know, that may be one point that I always warn against.
There's also, I mean, you could also take things too far in the right direction, meaning that, you know, it's kind of a strange thing because an idea that might work conceptually or formally might not work in other aspects that you need to attend to because, you know, there's certain characteristics of architecture that are, you know, unavoidably necessary. So although you might have a wonderful idea that works in certain regards, it might not work in others, and you have to learn, you know, you have to feel, be able to know when to let go of it before it's too late. I mean, you know, there's a lot of it is kind of, I guess, just practice, but there's a beautiful about this. I don't know if you've ever heard of him. There's an architect, Portuguese architect named Álvaro Siza, who's spoken about this phenomenon that says, you know, a concept for a project can be, I forget the exact words, but it could become a monster that strangles the project. You know, it could constitute the life of the project, but if you don't perceive in time that this is impractical and it's not going to actually coalesce into a whole project, you know, it could strangle it and kill it or make it a failure. So, you know, you can be too idealistic too in that sense. You can say, oh, well, you know, this was my idea. I'm going to pursue it till the end. There is such a thing as wrongheadedness, like in everything else, you know.
I love the fact that I'm seeing the dialectic right here too. So that's pretty neat.
I try to convince her to compromise as much as I can.
I think we may be out of time. Am I correct? One more question. Gentlemen here.
I think there's a kind of like really crude materiality that's evident in your projects, and I don't mean that in at all disparaging way. Though I'd say it's the part that I like the least and that I find most interesting also. And you see it in the drawings and in the models, like in the project with the trees in the middle of the house, how thick the line is of the wall around the trees and the poche, and how you can feel the materiality of that wall. And my question is both how that relates to how you develop a project between the drawings and the models and the built product, but also more generally to what I see as a kind of ethics in your work.
Yeah, you know, we have. Can I respond there? We have experienced different levels of commitment to what is considered a good architectural presentation. But there's a kind of roughness that doesn't mean lack of quality, but I think it means respect for doing only what is necessary to achieve what you want. It's kind of economy of work, you know. Once the project embodies what you want it to embody, once you've achieved what you want from the point of view of developing the project, you don't have to, I think, belabor and make everything perfect from the point of view of presentation. You know, I suppose this is a different story when you're talking about actual construction, you know. But I think there's a kind of this was something that I touched upon during the presentation, but it had to be really quickly when I talk about laconic detailing, you know, the fact that an excessive amount of attention that you put on something can ruin it as much as lack of attention. You know, I think there's a kind of equilibrium. You know, you don't want to put too many spices in one sauce because you will ruin the dish. So there are certain things that had to be kind of, you know, carefully disregarded in order for the balance of the whole thing to I mean, and this is, you know, I know that this is, you know, very abstractly spoken, but regarding, for example, that house in the countryside, we choose to use the materials that are there, not only because it's practical and makes the project possible, but also we think it kind of makes it resonate with the environment. I mean, if you know the place, you would just know that being more refined, even if you have the resources, it wouldn't just make any sense. You know, the house would become some kind of oddity. It would become some kind of freak. So in that context, you know, architecture is always part of something larger. So there's a kind of way of recruiting things that are already there and orchestrating them to create something that goes beyond the boundaries of the project in itself. In this case, for example, you know, if you build a house in a vineyard and all the vineyards in the, you know, it's a true community. There are a lot of vineyards and there are, you know, day laborers that worked in them, and, it, you know, there's a form of rural urbanity, let's say, you know, to use an oxymoron, that is an existing consideration and part of a deeper understanding of the site. So if all of a sudden you exceed, you know, to an incredible degree the kind of material quality in a very literal and superficial way that everything else has, you kind of setting off balance, the equilibrium of that community. That doesn't mean that within the palette of things that you decide to use, you cannot be extremely ambitious as to get the best possible result, you know. I mean, you can do Adobe block better than anybody else and have a great result, but at the same time, there's always going to be a roughness, a kind of, that's from that, you can also look at it from the point of view of the desirability of that roughness, right, of the actual, the enjoyment that you might draw or the kind of possible ground for meaning that you can prepare by eliciting that roughness that is proper to the material. Not everything has to be perfectly sleek and painted or, you know, reflective or plastified, you know. Plastic is nice in certain conditions, you know, but we try not to fetishize material in that way to become, you know, part of this or that movement. This has to do with the idea of not looking out the window too much. But, you know, it's better to look inside and try to figure out what all these things mean. You know, there are a lot of societies in the world, and they have different levels of technological development. So, you know, things that might seem outmoded for us here, of course, are, you know, perfectly current in other parts of the world, and I think that's what makes it interesting about the possibility in working in different places. Yeah. Anyways,
thank you very much. Thank you.